At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to Dr. Creepin's dungeon. Monsters are real. Ghosts are real too. They live inside us. And sometimes, they win. Four deliciously evil tales of terror for you this evening. Later on, we have The Children of Woodharrow Park by Certain Shadows. Then we have The Haunter of the Ring by Robert E. Howard. Our final story is Closed Eyes by Black Eyes and French Fries. But we open up proceedings with The Huntsville Camping Trip, an anonymous story. Now, as ever before we begin, a word of caution. Tonight's stories may contain strong language, as well as descriptions of violence and horrific imagery. If that sounds like your kind of thing, then let's begin. I went camping about 3 weekends ago in the Huntsville National Forest in Texas. Me and 3 friends that came home for the weekend. They're all in college and usually we all get together at least once a year. All friends from high school. For the camping trip, we plan to go backpacking deep in the forest. Live off of fish that we catch and animals that we can trap. Now, we've been doing this for a while in Texas and in numerous places. Arizona, Colorado, if anyone's familiar with the Spanish peaks there, or New Mexico, so, well, we're pretty much used to anything you'd encounter out there. It was my turn to pick where we went camping, so I chose Huntsville. Well, more accurately, it's Huntsville, New Waverly. So we drive up there and park our car in a camping park spot and start walking off into the forest. We had some laughs along the way, everyone catching up with each other's lives. We walked until it started to get dark and set up camp where we stopped. Everyone gathered wood to make a fire and we set our tent up. And we do what we always do, try and scare each other with weird stories. Around this time we started to smell something very faint. It was noticeable but not overbearing. We couldn't put our finger on what it was, so we just carried on. Mike had to go piss, and he walked off into the forest. A second later, he came running back, piss all down his jeans like he'd missed really bad. Immediately, we all crack up and throw some jokes at him. Then we noticed he was white as snow and trying to catch his breath. He starts screaming for us to follow him and runs off. We all get serious and go follow him, not knowing what the problem was. We start to hear a faint scream and crying in the distance, in the direction we were running. It was pitch black away from the camp, and Mike had the only flashlight. We'd left ours at the camp. He had his from his trip taking a piss. And so at this stage, we didn't have much choice but to follow the light, which was frantically pointing here and there in front of him. The scream gets closer, and Mike starts to slow down. We then noticed a ratty old cabin that looked like it was abandoned, except for a faint light that we could see from one of the old mildew-covered windows. And the crying was intense. Whoever it was couldn't breathe enough to let out a full yell. We all followed Mike up to the front door. We could all hear the crying from inside. As soon as he knocked on the door, it stopped. Now we all waited and heard really heavy footsteps walking fast to the door. There was a giant slam against the door and the sound of a bolt unlocking. And then, nothing. We waited for a bit, knocked a few more times, but still nothing happened. We walked around the house. There was no fucking way any of us were leaving each other's side. And we noticed a window, which is a good way up. Alex took a deep breath and asked us to give him a boost so he could see inside. Well, me and Mike lifted him up to the window. We watched him brush away dirt and webs from the window and place his face close to it to try and see something. There was a quick beat, and suddenly he breathed in fast and let out a loud scream. Then he fell back from the window, screaming bloody murder all the way. We tried to calm him down, but he was hysterical. We went to him, but he started to shake, to punch, kick, and cuss, you name it. And he then took off towards the camp. None of us wanted to be separated, so we all ran close behind him. We caught up to him and grabbed him and set him down. The fire was dying out, so I grabbed some nearby wood that we collected and added it to the fire. My hands were shaking, but I had to do something. I went back to Alex and we all tried to calm him down. He wouldn't. He just kept screaming and breathing so hard that he eventually fainted. All of us are terrified now and we all kept the fire high until sunrise. Periodically, Alex kept waking up, screaming just like before. By sunrise, he was up and looked catatonic, just mumbling to himself and whimpering. So, me and Mike decided to go look at the cabin now it was daylight. We searched where we thought it was, except there was nothing there. Nothing at all. The indistinct smell from last night had now grown into a very strong smell of something dead, something stale. We headed back to the camping site. And when we got there, we found Alex had chewed into the sides of his face and swallowed so much blood that he was throwing up. John was at his back, and he looked like he was about to die from exhaustion. I guess we all looked that way. I just didn't notice until I saw his face. Alex said quietly that we needed to leave. Now. We all started to pack up the tent. It started to rain really heavily. It was about noon, and the sky started to grow really dark. Alex started to go into a panic. He went and grabbed a large stick and yelled at us to leave it. Leave now, or he'd knock us out and drag us out of here himself. Mike started to yell at him, and they started to fight. We broke it up and finished packing, and then started to make our way back. After a little while, we arrived at a creek we crossed the previous day, only it was flooded over, and the water was moving too fast for us to cross it. Alex started to scream again, yelling at Mike for taking his time packing up the tent when we could have gotten out of there earlier. This went on for a while until we finally convinced Alex to calm down and tell us what had happened. He said as soon as he put his face to the glass, a face on the other side did the same thing and started to smile really big. It had dark eyes and a dark mouth, which was much bigger than Alex's, and the smile got as large as it could. A giant shadow behind it swung something down and sliced its face off. The face was stuck to the window, and he said it started to laugh quietly as it slid down. Mike, still pissed off and though he wouldn't admit it, beginning to get freaked out, started to argue with him again. We eventually started to follow the creek for a way to cross. We then started to see toys floating in the creek. Really old toys. Old Barbie dolls and other baby dolls. This wasn't like any old trash floating in the creek, though. This was a lot of Barbies and a lot of baby dolls. One washed towards the side and Mike picked it up. It had some kind of a voice chip that was dying and started to say some gurgling words we couldn't understand, followed by its sad excuse for laughter. Then it sounded like it was whispering. We thought the batteries must be dying, and he threw it down. We kept going, and the sun was starting to set. Alex was freaking out more now, and was whimpering and breathing heavily. We all started to see shadows move behind trees. Something we all called BS on until we were all seeing it. It was barely light out and we stopped as we could see the cabin right in front of us. None of us knew what to think. Mike says, "This is bullshit. I'm going in there." Alex tries to stop him. We all do. All of us just wanted to go home. Mike says to all of us to fuck off. Do our own thing. He doesn't care anymore. This is all bull. We start to hear hundreds of the same sort of baby doll as before. Laughing, whispering, trying to sing. We start to move forward past the cabin. All of us kept pushing forward. We smell something dead in the air. Something stale. The same something as before. We started to hear something crying. Something screaming. We kept on going. We eventually crossed the creek and left the woods. Got back to our vehicle and got in. It's pitch black and we drive. We're about to get on the 45 to Houston, but the road is under construction and can't be accessed. Points to a detour. As we head towards the detour, it seems to be a small, bumpy dirt road going into the woods. We then see a young girl come up to us. She looks like she was in trouble, young and pretty. She approaches the passenger side door and she looks like she's really drugged up, or beaten up. Alex doesn't roll down the windows, nor does he open the door. She reaches for the handle and he immediately locks it. She puts her face on the window and starts to smile, really big. We floor it. Alex starts to cry and scream and we're all breathing heavy. We finally cut onto a street that takes us onto the 45 and we take it the whole way. When we get back to my apartment, everybody doesn't know what to say and we all break apart and go our separate ways. Mike messages me later and says he's going to go back. Well, I try to convince him not to and all he does is say it was our own minds that were screwing with us. I think he just went to prove to himself he wasn't scared. But I can smell that stench everywhere now. I don't go out anymore. I just stay in and don't answer the door. Last week, everyone I met was acting really strange. People that I knew for a long time and total strangers. My own dad, when I went to his place to eat supper with him, he just watched me. Strangely, when I was sitting down, he didn't say a word the whole time. I kept asking him, "What's wrong?" He just slowly shook his head. When I was leaving to go up, I turned to wave. He had black eyes and an open mouth, like he was in pain. When I started to walk back, he shut the door and bolted it. I stared there, knocking and knocking, nothing. I called to him. I called his phone, but it was disconnected. He even called the police. Halfway through the questions they were asking me, the connection started to fade into static. I could hear a faint mumbling, singing and laughing. Mike has completely vanished. There's not even a record of him being alive. When I call Alex's house, they talk to me like I'm some salesman. They say they don't know any Alex and to please stop calling. The person who tells me that is Alex's mother. I can't get a hold of John. Someone knocked on my door and when I went to look, I saw a face completely covering the peephole and a giant smile started to form. I called the cops again and instead of it turning into static, they got really strange. "Sir, are you affected by any drugs at the moment?"
"No."
"Are you coming home anytime soon?"
"Excuse me."
"Come home." And the phone call ended. My mail slot swings every now and then. Someone is sliding pieces of baby dolls through it. I try to call people now and all I can hear is static and bad baby doll noises and this crying and screaming. My TV is busted, but when I go to piss, I can hear it turn on. God. Be going insane. Whoever lives above me started to scream in pain and cry deeply recently. I hear giant footsteps from their apartment. I hear bangs and something falling to the ground. From the neighbors to the right of my apartment, I hear what sounds like a baby that never gets tended to, and then it sounds like a baby doll whose batteries are dying. My phone's been ringing now, and it's Alex telling me things in a language that I've never heard before, nor could even manage to repeat. I keep getting emails of pictures of black and small colorations that I can't even now even access my email. Someone knocks on the door, and they slam against it. I hear the bolts unlocking one by one, and I run to make sure to lock all of them back. And then I sit down and begin to cry.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
My life had recently been plagued by a persistent bout of rotten luck. I'd been terminated from my last job. The weeks spent unemployed were slipping into months despite the stacks of applications I'd filled out, and every credit card I possessed had been maxed out to its limit. Bitterness and self-loathing had poisoned every fiber of my being and left me with an inescapable melancholy that I was starting to believe was incurable. My latest humiliation had been to dig through my wallet for spare change as a cashier fixed me with a plastered-on smile and an impatient line grew behind me, only to find that I still didn't have enough money to purchase a meager amount of groceries. I'd headed to Woodharrow Park afterwards, a local secluded, sleepy stretch of land, to clear my head. The park was empty when I arrived, leaving me free to wander the paths alone and, aimlessly. Hunger gnawed away at me like a familiar enemy I could never quite shake. In a final indignity, the previously sunny sky suddenly began to pour rain. I, of course, was not carrying an umbrella. I was so absorbed in my own misery that I barely felt the gentle tug on my jacket sleeve. Looking back, I wish I just kept walking along the park path without so much as glancing downwards. I wish that I'd ignored the soft, silent plea for my attention. I wish that I hadn't made the horrible mistake of believing that a hand with such a touch, so timid and helpless, was incapable of holding the power to be terrifying. But instead, I foolishly stopped in my tracks, and ever since that fateful decision, I've not had a single moment of peace. I looked down to see two children standing at my side, and immediately felt a jolt of unpleasant surprise. Both stood no higher than my waist, one slightly taller than the other, and both were clad in dark raincoats that looked more suited for a sepia-toned photograph than a modern-day child. They each wore matching wide-brim hats that drooped atop their small heads and obscured most of their faces. Though I could vaguely discern that the taller of the pair was a boy and the shortest a girl, I was unable to see any features above the pallid flesh of their swollen cheeks. Their lips were so colourless that it appeared as if they had a little more than a thin white sliver for a mouth. The children's bodies were round, but without any of the cherubic softness associated with youth. Rather, they looked unnaturally bulbous, bloated to the point of near grotesqueness. Unbrushed tufts of stringy blonde hair jutted from beneath their hats like tangled straw, dry as a brittle bone and seemingly untouched by so much as a single drop of rain. Hello, I said, forcing myself to sound upbeat. They stared up at me in silence. The girl continued to cling to my sleeve. Are you okay? I asked. By now I was drenched and eager to head back to my car. Do you need some help? But the pair remained mute. I stood there awkwardly, unsure what to do. and the girl suddenly began to grip my arm with a startling strength that made me worry she would pull me to the ground. Alarms rang loudly throughout my brain. I felt an immediate urge to extract myself from her unsettling grasp and leave them both behind in the rain. Well, I warily pulled my arm away, somewhat embarrassed for being afraid of how the pair would react. If you don't need anything, I guess I'll be on my way. She released her hold on me without protest. Neither said a word as I walked away. When I turned around for a final look of parting, I saw that they were still staring at me. Though I couldn't see their eyes, I felt their gaze follow me with an intensity that disturbed me no matter how much distance I put between us. I didn't look back again. I picked up my pace and dug my keys out of my pocket. The rain fell as cold as ever. I unlocked my car and was thinking about the can of chicken noodle soup I had left in my spouse's pantry when I noticed that the girl had left behind a stain on my sleeve, as dark as ink and shaped like her tiny fingers. I wiped at it with my thumb, but the mark didn't budge. I sighed and looked up, only to nearly stumble backwards in shock when I saw the back seat door open and the girl sitting inside. She'd removed her hat and was holding it in her hands, both of which were clean despite the mark on my jacket, with her head bowed and her knotted hair concealing her face like a curtain. Hey! I tried to keep my tone from betraying how unnerved I was and failed spectacularly. What are you doing in here? She sat as wordless as before, tightly squeezing and twisting the brim of her hat with such violence that I was certain she would rip it apart. I swallowed my uneasiness. Look, I said as calmly as I could manage, if there's something wrong, I can't help you if you don't tell me what it is. I reached into my pocket and pulled out my phone. Maybe it's better if I call the police, and you can tell them. My voice trailed off as I watched my phone screen flicker on and off before collapsing into a scramble of pixels and shutting down entirely. I stared agape at my reflection in the black screen as a terrible feeling of dread began to wash over me. When I looked back up, the girl was gone. In her place rested her hat. The hat appeared soaked, every bit as saturated with rain as my own clothes were. But unlike the jacket and jeans that clung to my skin and chilled me to the bone, the hat didn't feel wet when I picked it up with a trembling hand. It was dry to the touch, even as I watched beads of rain drip from its brim and onto the car's upholstery. I realized, with something between fascination and horror, that the raindrops left behind no traces where they landed. And when I cut my hand beneath the hat to catch the drops in my palm, I felt nothing but air. Furthermore, the back seat was completely dry. There were no damp footprints, no water spots, nothing at all to indicate that a girl wearing a coat glistening with rain had been sitting there mere seconds ago. I turned to fling the foul thing into the parking lot and gasped out loud when I saw the boy standing only a few feet away. She forgot her hat, I said dimly, my heart thundering madly in my chest. My mind screamed at me to jump into the car, to drive off as fast as I could and never come back to Woodharrow Park ever again, but it was that same fear that left me rooted to the spot, paralyzed and helpless, even as the boy stepped ever closer towards me. Stop it! I wanted to scream, but my tongue felt too thick to form the words. The boy lifted his hat. A burst of darkness erupted in my eyes, blinding me as a hellish symphony assailed my other senses. I could neither see nor move as I felt insects scuttling behind my eyes and scales slithering inside of my skull. The vile taste of putrid water filled my mouth as the deathly scent of rot flooded my nostrils. Final breaths rattling in dying throats, drowning bodies thrashing in water as they sank, screams of agony so shrill that they sounded inhuman. I heard them all and many hideous more. I stood frozen in the terrifying darkness as the rain furiously slashed at my flesh like cold blades. unable to weep or let out a watery cry for help. Suddenly, I felt someone grab hold of my hand and pull me free from the loathsome trance just as abruptly as I'd been consumed by it. My vision returned, and I saw that I was now alone. Even the girl's hat had disappeared. I dove into my car and sped away from Woodharrow Park. The sky grew clearer with every mile. When I got home, I peeled off my wet clothes and climbed into the shower. I sat there beneath the hot spray, immersing myself in the steam and the warmth, and jumped out the instant it turned cold. I dried off and crawled into my bed, burying myself beneath the blankets as my mind raced with the nightmare I had endured. I wondered if the children, whoever they were, had somehow been drawn to the despair I'd felt as I walked through the park. Perhaps my hopelessness and sorrow had served as a miserable beacon, guiding them towards me and leaving me vulnerable to their presence. There was one thing I knew for certain. It was the girl who'd rescued me. I'd known it the second I felt her small hand touch mine. I realized now that she hadn't climbed into the car to frighten me. She'd only wanted me to stay with her in the park. Tears slid down my cheeks as I thought of her, forced to forever wander Woodharrow with no one but a boy who carried hell beneath his hat to keep her company. Maybe she too had once visited the park, while bearing a sadness as heavy as my own, only to wind up imprisoned by it. I slept fitfully. When I woke the following morning, I discovered that the stain on my coat sleeve had somehow bled onto my arm. I spent hours trying to wash it off, scouring my flesh until it grew angry and raw, but the mark refused to be cleansed away. I sat on the floor of my bathroom, gazed down into the imprint of the girl's fingers on my reddened skin, and felt the horrid chill of Woodharrow's rain creep down my spine. Well, that was last week. The mark still remains on my arm, and at night I toss and turn and vividly dream of the park. Told myself repeatedly that I can't go back there, that I was lucky to have made it out alive and might not be so fortunate again. But I can't stop thinking about the girl. I pity and fear her in equal measure. When it rains, I look out the window and wonder if I'll see her outside, waiting for me, clutching her hat and bowing her tangled head. Well, the thought both saddens and terrifies me. So I've made a decision, and perhaps I'll live long enough to regret this one, too. As soon as I finish posting this, I'm grabbing my car keys and driving to Woodharrow Park. I know that I might be walking towards my own doom. I know that the marks on my arm are likely a bad omen. I know that the girl may be every bit as malevolent as the boy, and that she may be trying to lure me into a trap of her own. I know that there's a strong chance I'll never be able to come back and tell you what happened. But I can't keep reliving the same nightmare over and over again. In a way, I never truly left Woodharrow. My mind wanders its paths, even as I hide away in my home. I've got to go now. Wish me luck. I have a feeling it's going to rain. The Haunter of the Ring. As I entered John Kirwan's study, I was too much engrossed in my own thoughts to notice, at first, the haggard appearance of his visitor, a big, handsome young fellow well known to me. "Hello, Kirwan," I greeted. "Hello, Gordon. Haven't seen you for quite a while. How's Evelyn?" And before he could answer, still on the crest of the enthusiasm which had brought me there, I exclaimed, "Look here, you fellows. I've got something that will make you stare. I got it from that robber Ahmed Mektub, and I paid high for it, but it's worth it. Look." From under my coat, I drew the jewel-hilted Afghan dagger which had fascinated me as a collector of rare weapons. Kirwan, familiar with my passion, showed only polite interest, but the effect on Gordon was shocking. With a strangled cry, he sprang up and backward, knocking the chair clattering to the floor. fists clenched and countenance livid, he faced me, crying, "Get back! Get away from me, or—" I was frozen in my tracks. "What in the—" I began bewilderedly, when Gordon, with another amazing change of attitude, dropped into a chair and sank his head in his hands. I saw his heavy shoulders quiver. I stared helplessly from him to Kirawan, who seemed equally dumbfounded. "Is he drunk?" I asked. Kirawan shook his head, and, filling a brandy glass, offered it to the man. Gordon looked up with haggard eyes, seized the drink, and gulped it down like a man half famished. Then he straightened up and looked at us shamefacedly. "I'm sorry I went off my handle, O'Donnell," he said. "It was the unexpected shock of you drawing that knife." "Well," I retorted with some disgust, "I suppose you thought I was going to stab you with it." "Yes, I did." And then, at the utterly blank expression on my face, he added, "Oh, I didn't actually think that. At least, I didn't reach that conclusion by any process of reasoning. It was just the blind, primitive instinct of a hunted man, against whom anyone's hand may be turned." His strange words and the despairing way he said them sent a queer shiver of nameless apprehension down my spine. "What are you talking about?" I demanded uneasily. "Hunted? For what? You never committed a crime in your life." "Not in this life, perhaps," he muttered. "What do you mean?" "What if retribution for a black crime committed in a previous life were hounding me?" he muttered. "That's nonsense," I snorted. "Oh, is it?" he exclaimed, stung. "Did you ever hear of my great-grandfather, Sir Richard Gordon of Argyle?" "Sure, but what's he got to do with—" "You've seen his portrait. Doesn't it resemble me?" "Well, yes," I admitted. "Except that your expression is frank and wholesome, whereas his is crafty and cruel." He murdered his wife," answered Gordon. "Suppose the theory of reincarnation were true. Why shouldn't a man suffer in one life for a crime committed in another?"
"You mean you think you're the reincarnation of your great-grandfather? Of all the fantastic—" "Well, since he killed his wife, I suppose you'll be expecting Evelyn to murder you." This last was delivered in searing sarcasm, as I thought of the sweet, gentle girl Gordon had married. His answer stunned me. "My wife," he said slowly, "has tried to kill me 3 times in the past week." Well, there was no reply to that. I glanced helplessly at John Kirawan. He sat in his customary position, chin resting on his strong, slim hands. His white face was immobile, but his dark eyes gleamed with interest. In the silence, I heard a clock ticking like a death watch.
"Tell us the full story, Gordon," suggested Kirawan, and his calm, even voice was like a knife that cut a strangling, relieving the unreal tension.
"You know I've been married less than a year," Gordon began, plunging into the tale as though he were bursting for utterance. His words stumbled and tripped over one another.
"All couples have spats, of course, but we've never had any real quarrels. Evelyn is the best-natured girl in the world."
"Well, the first thing out of the ordinary occurred about a week ago. We'd driven up into the mountains, left the car, and were wandering around picking wild flowers. At last we came to a steep slope, some 30 feet in height, and Evelyn drew my attention to the flowers which grew thickly at the foot. I was looking over the edge and wondering if I could climb down without tearing my clothes to ribbons, when I felt a violent shove from behind me that toppled me over. Well, if it had been a sheer cliff, I'd have broken my neck. As it was, I went tumbling down, rolling and sliding, and brought up at the bottom scratched and bruised, with my garments in rags. I looked up and saw Evelyn staring down, apparently frightened half out of her wits.
"Oh, Jim," she cried, "are you hurt? How came you to fall?"
Well, it was on the tip of my tongue to tell her that there was such a thing as carrying a joke too far, but these words checked me. I decided she must have stumbled against me unintentionally,
and actually didn't know it was she who had precipitated me down the slope. Yeah, so I laughed it off and went home. Oh, she made a great fuss over me, insisted on swabbing my scratches with iodine, and lectured me for my carelessness. I hadn't the heart to tell her it was her fault. But 4 days later, the next thing happened. I was walking along our driveway when I saw her coming up in the automobile. I stepped out on the grass to let her by, as there isn't any curb along the driveway. She was smiling as she approached me and slowed down the car, as if to speak to me. Then, just before she reached me, a most horrible change came over her expression. Without warning, the car leaped at me like a living thing as she drove her foot down on the accelerator. Only a frantic leap backward saved me from being ground under the wheels. The car shot across the lawn and crashed into a tree. I ran to it and found Evelyn dazed and hysterical, but unhurt. She babbled of losing control of the machine. I carried her into the house and sent for Dr. Donnelly. He found nothing seriously wrong with her and attributed her dazed condition to fright and shock. Within half an hour, she'd regained her normal senses, but she's refused to touch the wheel since. Strange to say, she seemed less frightened on her own account than on mine. She seemed vaguely to know that she'd nearly run me down, and grew hysterical again when she spoke of it. Yet she seemed to take it for granted that I knew the machine had got out of her control. But I distinctly saw her wrench the wheel around, and I know she deliberately tried to hit me. Why, God alone knows. But still, I refused to let my mind follow the channel it was getting into. Evelyn had never given any evidence of any psychological weakness or nerves. She's always been a level-headed girl, wholesome and natural. But I began to think she was subject to crazy impulses. Yeah, most of us have the impulse to leap from tall buildings, and sometimes a person feels a blind, childish, and utterly reasonless urge to harm someone. We pick up a pistol, and the thought suddenly enters our mind how easy it would be to send our friend, who sits smiling and unaware, into eternity with the touch of a trigger. Well, of course, we don't do it, but the impulse is there. So I thought perhaps some lack of mental discipline made Evelyn susceptible to these unguided impulses, and unable to control them. Nonsense, I broke in. I've known her since she was a baby. If she has any such trait, she's developed it since she married you. Well, it was an unfortunate remark. Gordon caught it up with a despairing gleam in his eyes. Well, that's just it. Since she married me, it's a curse. A black, ghastly curse, crawling like a serpent out of the past. I tell you, I was Richard Gordon, and she was Lady Elizabeth, his murdered wife. His voice sank to a blood-freezing whisper. I shuddered. Oh, it's an awful thing to look upon the ruin of a keen, clean brain, and such I was certain that I surveyed in James Gordon. Why or how, or by what grisly chance it had come about, I could not say. But I was certain the man was mad. You spoke of 3 attempts. It was John Kirwan's voice again, calm and stable amid the gathering webs of horror and unreality. Look here. Gordon lifted his arm, drew back the sleeve, and displayed a bandage, the cryptic significance of which was intolerable. I came into the bathroom this morning looking for my razor, he said. I found Evelyn just on the point of using my best shaving implement for some feminine purpose, to cut out a pattern or something. Well, like many women, she can't seem to realize the difference between a razor and a butcher knife or a pair of shears. Well, I was a bit irritated and said, Evelyn, how many times have I told you not to use my razors for such things? Bring it here, I'll give you my pocket knife. Well, I'm sorry, Jim, she said. I didn't know it would hurt the razor. Here it is. She was advancing, holding the open razor toward me. I reached for it, and then something warned me. It was the same look in her eyes, just as I'd seen it the day she nearly ran over me. That was all that saved my life, for I instinctively threw my hand up just as she slashed at my throat with all her power. The blade gashed my arm, as you see, before I caught her wrist. For an instant she fought like a wild thing, Her slender body was taut as steel beneath my hands. And then she went limp, and the look in her eyes was replaced by a strange, dazed expression. And the razor slipped out of her fingers. I let go of her, and she stood swaying as if about to faint. I went to the lavatory. My wound was bleeding in a beastly fashion. And the next thing, I heard her cry out, and she was hovering over me. "Jim," she cried, "how did you cut yourself so terribly?" Gordon shook his head and sighed heavily. I guess I was a bit out of my head. Well, my self-control snapped. "Oh, don't keep up this pretense, Evelyn," I said. "God knows what's got into you, but you know as well as I that you've tried to kill me 3 times in the past week." She recoiled as if I'd struck her, catching at her breast and staring at me as if at a ghost. She didn't say a word. And just what I said, I don't remember, but when I finished, I left her standing there white and still as a marble statue. I got my arm bandaged at a drugstore, then came over here, not knowing what else to do. "Kirwan, O'Donnell, it's damnable. Either my wife is subject to fits of insanity." He choked on that word. No, I can't believe it. Ordinarily, her eyes are too clear and level, too utterly sane, but every time she has an opportunity to harm me, she seems to become a temporary maniac. He beat his fists together in his impotence and agony. "But it isn't insanity. I used to work on a psychopathic ward, and I've seen every form of mental imbalance. My wife is not insane." "Then what?" I began, but he turned his haggard eyes on me. "Only one alternative remains," he answered. "It's the old curse. From the days when I walked the earth with a heart as black as hell's darkest pits, and did evil in the sight of man and of God. She knows. In fleeting snatches of memory, people have seen before, have glimpsed forbidden things in momentary liftings of the veil, which bars life from life. She was Elizabeth Douglas, the ill-fated bride of Richard Gordon, whom he murdered in jealous frenzy, and the vengeance is hers. I shall die by her hands, as it was meant to be. And she..." He bowed his head in his hands. "Just a moment." It was Kirwan again. "You've mentioned a strange look in your wife's eyes. What sort of a look? Was it of maniacal frenzy?" Gordon shook his head. "It was utter blankness. All the life and intelligence simply vanished, leaving her eyes dark wells of emptiness." Kirwan nodded and asked a seemingly irrelevant question. "Have you any enemies?" "Not that I know of." "Oh, you forget Joseph Roloff," I said. "I can't imagine that elegant sophisticate going to the trouble of doing you any actual harm, but I have an idea that if he could discomfort you without any physical effort on his part, he'd do it with a right good will." Kirwan turned on me an eye that had suddenly become piercing. "And who is this Joseph Roloff?" "A young exquisite who came into Evelyn's life and nearly rushed her off her feet for a while. But in the end she came back to her first love, Gordon here. And Roloff took it pretty hard. For all his suaveness, there's a streak of violence and passion in the man that might have cropped out but for his infernal indolence and blasé indifference." "Oh, there's nothing to be said against Roloff," interrupted Gordon impatiently. "He must know that Evelyn never really loved him. He merely fascinated her temporarily with his romantic Latin air." "Not exactly Latin, Jim," I protested. "Roloff does look foreign, but it isn't Latin. It's almost Oriental." "Well, what has Roloff got to do with this matter?" Gordon snarled with the irascibility of frayed nerves. "He's been as friendly as a man could have been since Evelyn and I were married. In fact, only a week ago he sent her a ring, which he said was a peace offering and a belated wedding gift. Said that, after all, her jailing him was a greater misfortune for her than it was for him. Oh, that conceited jackass." "A ring?" Kirwan suddenly came to life. It was as if something hard and steely had been sounded in him. "What sort of ring?" "Oh, a fantastic thing. Copper. made like a scaly snake coil three times, with its tail in its mouth and yellow jewels for eyes. I gather he picked it up somewhere in Hungary. And has he traveled a great deal in Hungary? Gordon looked surprised at this questioning, but answered. Why, apparently the man's traveled everywhere. I put him down as the pampered son of a millionaire. Yeah, he never did any work, so far as I know. Well, he's a great student, I put in. I've been up to his apartment several times, and I never saw such a collection of books. Gordon leaped to his feet with an oath. Are we all crazy? He cried. I came here hoping to get some help, and you fellows fall to talking of Joseph Rowlock. Oh, I'll go to Dr. Donnelly. Wait, Kirwan stretched out a detaining hand. If you don't mind, we'll go over to your house. I'd like to talk to your wife. Gordon dumbly acquiesced. Harried and haunted by grisly forebodings, he knew not which way to turn, and welcomed anything that promised aid. We drove over in his car, and scarcely a word was spoken on the way. Gordon was sunk in moody ruminations, and Kirwan had withdrawn himself into some strange, aloof domain of thought beyond my ken. He sat like a statue, his dark, vital eyes staring into space, not blankly, but as one who looks with understanding into some far realm. Though I counted the man as my best friend, I knew but little of his past. He had come into my life as abruptly and unannounced as Joseph Rowlock could come into the life of Evelyn Ash. I had met him at the Wanderers Club, which is composed of the drift of the world, travellers, eccentrics, and all manner of men whose paths lie outside the beaten tracks of life. I had been attracted to him and intrigued by his strange powers and deep knowledge. I vaguely knew that he was the black sheep younger son of a titled Irish family, and that he had walked many strange ways. Gordon's mention of Hungary struck a chord in my memory. One phase of his life Kirwan had once let drop fragmentarily. I only knew that he'd once suffered a bitter grief and a savage wrong, and that it had been in Hungary, but the nature of the episode I did not know. At Gordon's house, Evelyn met us calmly, showing inner agitation only by the over-restraint of her manner. I saw the beseeching look she stole at her husband. She was a slender, soft-spoken girl, whose dark eyes were always vibrant and alight with emotion. That child tried to murder her adored husband. The idea was monstrous. Again, I was convinced that James Gordon himself was deranged. Following Kirwan's lead, we made a pretense of small talk, as if we'd casually dropped in, but I felt that Evelyn was not deceived. Our conversation rang false and hollow, and presently Kirwan said, Mrs. Gordon, that is a remarkable ring you're wearing. Do you mind if I look at it? Oh, I'll have to give you my hand, she laughed. I've been trying to get it off today, but it won't come off. She held out her slim white hand for Kirwan's inspection, and his face was immobile as he looked at the metal snake that coiled about her slim finger. He did not touch it. I myself was aware of an unaccountable repulsion. There was almost something obscene about that dull, copperish reptile that was wound around the girl's white finger. It's evil-looking, isn't it? She involuntarily shivered. Well, at first I liked it, but now I can hardly bear to look at it. If I can get it off, I intend to return it to Joseph, Mr. Rowlock. Kirwan was about to make some reply when the doorbell rang. Gordon jumped as if shot, and Evelyn rose quickly. I'll answer it, Jim. I know who it is. She returned an instant later with two more mutual friends, those inseparable cronies, Dr. Donnelly, whose burly body, jovial manner, and booming voice were combined with as keen a brain as any of that in the profession, and Bill Bain, elderly, lean, wiry, and acidly witty. Both were old friends of the Ash family. Dr. Donnelly had ushered Evelyn into the world, and Bain was always Uncle Bill to her. Howdy, Jim. Howdy, Mr. Kirwan, roared Donnelly. Hey, O'Donnell. You got any firearms with you? Last time you nearly blew my head off showing me an old flintlock pistol that wasn't supposed to be loaded. Dr. Donnelly. We all turned. Evelyn was standing beside a wide table, holding it as if for support. Her face was white. Our badinage ceased instantly. A sudden tension was in the air. "Dr. Donnelly," she repeated, holding her voice steady by an effort. "I sent for you and Uncle Bill, for the same reason for which I know Jim has brought Mr. Kirwan and Michael. There's a matter Jim and I can no longer deal with alone. There is something between us, something black and ghastly and terrible." "What are you talking about, girl?" All the levity was gone from Donnelly's great voice. "My husband," she choked, then blindly went on. "My husband has accused me of trying to murder him." The silence that fell was broken by Bane's sudden and energetic rise. His eyes blazed and his fists quivered. "Oh, you young pup," he shouted at Gordon. "I'll knock the living daylight." "Ah, sit down, Bill." Donnelly's huge hand crushed his smaller companion back into his chair. "No use going off half-cocked. Go ahead, honey."
"We need help. We cannot carry this thing alone."
A shadow crossed her comely face.
"This morning Jim's arm was badly cut. He said I did it. I don't know. I was handing him the razor. Then I must have fainted. At least, well, everything faded away. When I came to myself, he was washing his arm in the lavatory and he accused me of trying to kill him."
"Why, the young fool," barked the belligerent Bane. "Hasn't he sense enough to know that if you did cut him, it was an accident?" "Ah, shut up, won't you?" snorted Donnelly. "Honey, did you say you fainted? Well, that isn't like you."
"Well, I've been having fainting spells," she answered. "First time was when we were in the mountains and Jim fell down a cliff. We were standing on the edge, then everything went black, and when my sight cleared, he was rolling down the slope."
She shuddered at the recollection.
"Then when I lost control of the car and crashed it into the tree, you remember, Jim called you over."
Dr. Donnelly nodded his head ponderously.
"I don't remember you ever having fainting spells before."
"Jim says I pushed him over the cliff," she cried hysterically. "He says I tried to run him down in the car. He says I purposely slashed him with a razor."
Dr. Donnelly turned perplexedly toward the wretched Gordon. "How about it, son?"
"God help me,"
Gordon burst out in agony.
"It's true."
"Why, you lying hound."
It was Bane who gave tongue, leaping again to his feet.
"If you want a divorce, why don't you get it in a decent way instead of resorting to these despicable tactics?"
"Damn you,"
roared Gordon, lunging up and losing control of himself completely.
"If you say that, I'll tear your jugular out."
Evelyn screamed. Donnelly grabbed Bane ponderously and banged him back into his chair with no overly gentle touch. Kirwan laid a hand lightly on Gordon's shoulder. The man seemed to crumple into himself. He sank back into his chair and held out his hands gropingly towards his wife.
"Evelyn,"
he said, his voice thick with laboring emotion,
"you know I love you. I feel like a dog, but God help me, it's true. If we go on this way, I'll be a dead man, and you..."
"Don't say it," she screamed.
"I know you wouldn't lie to me, Jim. If you say I tried to kill you, I know I did, but I swear, Jim, I didn't do it consciously. God, I must be going mad. That's why my dreams have been so wild and terrifying lately."
"Of what have you dreamed, Mrs. Gordon?" asked Kirwan gently. She pressed her hands to her temples and stared dully at him, as if only half comprehending.
A black thing," she muttered. "A horrible, faceless black thing that mows and mumbles and paws over me with apish hands. I dream of it every night, and in the daytime I try to kill the only man I ever loved. I'm going mad. Maybe I'm crazy already and I don't know it."
"Oh, calm yourself, honey."
To Dr. Donnelly, with all his science, it was only another case of feminine hysteria. His matter-of-fact voice seemed to soothe her, and she sighed and drew a weary hand through her damn locks.
"We'll talk all this over and everything's going to be okay," he said,
drawing a thick cigar from his vest pocket.
Give me a match, honey.
She began mechanically to feel about the table, and just as mechanically, Gordon said,
There are matches in the drawer, Evelyn.
She opened the drawer and began groping it, when suddenly, as if struck by recollection and intuition, Gordon sprang up, white-faced, and shouted,
No, no, don't open that drawer, don't!
Even as he voiced that urgent cry, she stiffened, as if at the feel of something in the drawer. Her change of expression held us all frozen, even Kirawan. The vital intelligence vanished from her eyes like a blown-out flame, and into them came the look Gordon had described as blank. The term was descriptive. Her beautiful eyes were dark wells of emptiness, as if the soul had been withdrawn from behind them. Her hand came out of the drawer holding a pistol, and she fired point blank. Gordon reeled with a groan and went down, blood starting from his head. For a flashing instant she looked down stupidly at the smoking gun in her hand, like one suddenly waking from a nightmare. Then her wild scream of agony smote our ears.
Oh God, I've killed him! Jim! Jim!
She reached him before any of us, throwing herself on her knees and cradling his body, head in her arms, while she sobbed in an unbearable passion of horror and anguish. The emptiness was gone from her eyes. They were alive and dilated with grief and terror. I was making toward my prostrate friend with Donnelly and Bane, but Kirawan caught my arm. His face was no longer immobile. His eyes glittered with a controlled savagery.
Leave him to them, he snarled. We are hunters, not healers. Lead me to the house of Joseph Rolong.
I didn't question him. We drove there in Gordon's car. I had the wheel. Something about the grim face of my companion caused me to hurl the machine recklessly through the traffic. I had the sensation of being part of a tragic drama which was hurtling with headlong speed towards a terrible climax. I wrenched the car to a grinding halt at the curb before the building where Rolong lived in a bizarre apartment high above the city. The very elevator that shot us skyward seemed imbued with something of Kirawan's driving urge for haste. I pointed out Rolog's door, and he cast it open without knocking and shouldered his way in. I was close at his heels. Rolog, in a dressing gown of Chinese silk worked with dragons, was lounging on a divan, puffing quickly at a cigarette. He sat up, overturning a wine glass which stood with a half-filled bottle at his elbow. Before Kirawan could speak, I burst out with our news.
James Gordon has been shot.
He sprang to his feet. Shot? When? When did she kill him?
She? I glared in bewilderment. How did you know?
With a steely hand, Kirawan thrust me aside. And as the men faced each other, I saw recognition flare up in Rolok's face. They made a strong contrast. Kirawan, tall, pale, with some white-hot passion. Rolok, slim, darkly handsome, with the Saracenic arch of his slim brows above his black eyes. I realized that whatever else occurred, it lay between these two men. They were not strangers. I could sense like a tangible thing the hate that lay between them. John Kirawan, softly whispered Rolok.
You remember me, Joseph Frollo.
Only an iron control kept Kirawan's voice steady. The other merely stared at him without speaking.
Years ago, said Kirawan more deliberately, when we delved in the dark mysteries together in Budapest, I saw whither you were drifting. I drew back. I would not descend to the foul depths of forbidden occultism and diabolism to which you sank. Because I would not... You despise me, and you rob me of the only woman I ever loved. You turned her against me by means of your vile arts, and then you degraded and debauched her, sank her into your own foul slime. Oh, had I killed you with my own hands then, Joseph Frolok, vampire by nature as well as by name that you are, but your arts protected you from physical vengeance. is. But you trapped yourself at last.
Kiroan's voice rose in fierce exultation. All his cultured restraint had been swept away from him, leaving a primitive, elemental man raging and gloating over a hated foe.
You sought the destruction of James Gordon and his wife, because she unwittingly escaped your snare. You...
Roelok shrugged his shoulders and laughed.
You are mad. I have not seen the Gordons for weeks. Why blame me for their family troubles?
Kiroan snarled.
Liar as always. What did you say just now when O'Donnell told you Gordon had been shot? When did she kill him?
You were expecting to hear that the girl had killed her husband.
Your psychic powers had told you that a climax was close at hand. You were nervously awaiting news of the success of your devilish scheme. But I did not need a slip of your tongue to recognize your handiwork. I knew as soon as I saw the ring on Evelyn Gordon's finger. The ring she could not remove. The ancient and accursed ring of Thoth Amon. Handed down by foul cults of sorcerers since the days of forgotten Stygia. I knew that ring was yours, and I knew by what ghastly rights you came to possess it. And I knew its power. Once you put it on her finger, in her innocence and ignorance, she was in your power. By your black magic, you summoned the black elemental spirit, the haunter of the ring, out of the gulfs of night and the ages. Here in your accursed chamber, you performed unspeakable rituals to drive Evelyn Gordon's soul from her body, and to cause that body to be possessed by that godless sprite from outside the human universe. She was too clean and wholesome. Her love for her husband too strong for the fiend to gain complete and permanent possession of her body. Only for brief instants could it drive her own spirit into the void and animate her form. But that was enough for your purpose. But you have brought ruin upon yourself by your vengeance.
Kiroan's voice rose to a feline screech.
What was the price demanded by the fiend you drew from the pits?
You blench. Joseph Frolok is not the only man to have learned forbidden secrets.
After I left Hungary, a broken man, I took up again the study of the black arts to trap you, you cringing serpent. I explored the ruins of Zimbabwe, the lost mountains of Inner Mongolia, and the forgotten jungle islands of the southern seas. I learned what sickened my soul, so that I forswore occultism forever. But I learned of the black spirit that deals death by the hand of a beloved one, and it is controlled by a master of magic. But, Joseph Frolok, you are not an adept. You have not the power to control the fiend you have invoked, and you have sold your soul.
The Hungarian tore at his collar as if it were a strangling noose. His face had changed, as if a mask had dropped away. He looked much older.
You lie, he panted. I did not promise him my soul. I do not lie.
Kiruan's shriek was shocking in its wild exultation.
I know the price a man must pay for calling forth the nameless shape that roams the gulfs of darkness. Look, there in the corner behind you, a nameless, sightless thing is laughing, is mocking you. It has fulfilled its bargain. And now it's come for you, Joseph Frolok.
No, no, shrieked Frolok, tearing his limp collar away from his sweating throat. His composure had crumpled, and his demoralization was sickening to see.
I tell you, it was not my soul. I promised it a soul, but not my soul. He must take the soul of the girl, or of James Gordon.
Fool, roared Kiruan. Do you think he could take the souls of innocence? And he would not know that they were beyond his reach. The girl and the youth he could kill, their souls were not his to take or yours to give. But your black soul is not beyond his reach, and he will have his wage. Look, he's materializing behind you. He's growing out of thin air. Was it the hypnosis inspired by Kiruan's burning words that caused me to shudder and grow cold? To feel an icy chill that was not of earth pervade the room. Was it a trick of light and shadow that seemed to produce the effect of a black anthropomorphic shadow on the wall behind the Hungarian? No. By heaven, it grew, it swelled. Vrolok had not turned. He stared at Kirwan with eyes starting from his head, hair standing stiffly on his scalp, sweat dripping from his livid face. And Kirwan's cry started shudders down my spine. Look behind you, fool. I see him. He has come. He is here. His grisly mouth gapes in awful laughter, his misshapen paws reaching for you. And then, at last, Vrolok wheeled with an awful shriek, throwing his arms above his head in a gesture of wild despair. And for one brain-shattering instant, he was blotted out by a great black shadow. Kirwan grasped my arm and we fled from that accursed chamber, blind with horror. The same paper, which bore a brief item telling of James Gordon having suffered a slight scalp wound by the accidental discharge of a pistol in his home, headlined the sudden death of Joseph Rolock, wealthy and eccentric clubman, in his sumptuous apartments, apparently from heart failure. I read it at breakfast, while I drank cup after cup of black coffee, from a hand that was not too steady even after the lapse of a night. Across the table from me, Kirwan likewise seemed to lack appetite. He brooded as if he roamed again through bygone years. Gordon's fantastic theory of reincarnation was wild, though, I said at last. But the actual facts were still more incredible. Tell me, Kirwan, was that last scene the result of hypnosis? Was it the power of your words that made me seem to see some black horror grow out of the air and rip Joseph Rolock's soul from his living body? He shook his head. No human hypnotism would strike that black-hearted devil dead on the floor. No, there are beings outside the ken of common humanity, foul shapes of transcosmic evil. Such a one it was with which Vrolok dealt. But how could it claim his soul, I persisted, if indeed such an awful bargain had been struck? It had not fulfilled its part. But James Gordon was not dead, but merely knocked senseless. Vrolok didn't know it, answered Kirwan. He thought that Gordon was dead, and I convinced him that he himself had been trapped and was doomed. In his demoralization, he fell easy prey to the thing he called forth. It, of course, was always watching for a moment of weakness on his part. The powers of darkness never deal fairly with human beings. He who traffics with them is always cheated in the end. It's a mad nightmare, I muttered. But it seems to me, then, that you, as much as anything else, brought about Vrolok's death. It is gratifying to think so, Kirwan answered. Evelyn Gordon is safe now, and it is a small repayment for what he did to another girl years ago in a far country.
I just managed to escape that creature and tell this story as I hide in my apartment closet. Now, I apologize if this is a little sloppy, but that's only because I don't have much time. I'm saying this to warn you, and everyone, of this monstrosity that is going to be the death of me in a short amount of time. It is a creature referred to as Trapo Espiritu, which is Spanish for rag spirit. Yes, I know it sounds dumb, but please, keep listening. I was warned about this being by my mother, who has recently been warned by her mum. A generation to generation sort of thing. Well, anyways, Trapo Espiritu is supposedly known to go from house to house each night, provoking the host of the house and slowly and brutally killing them. Where Trapo strikes next is never known. But death can be avoided, and that's precisely what I am here to tell you. First off, if Trapo is to be visiting you next, you'll know the day that follows the night of its coming. There are four signs of Trapo's approach. Your day will go smoothly, and not a thing wrong should happen, except you'll have a strong gut feeling that something isn't right. Throughout your day, you'll be able to see figures in your peripheral vision wherever you go. Surprisingly, this will not scare or startle you. But whenever you turn to see the figure face to face, it will have vanished as if it were never there. These figures are believed to be the ghosts of Trapo Espiritu's past victims. You will have gone somewhere on this day. Maybe to work or the store, but somewhere nonetheless. You will come home, and when you do, you should see a small piece of white notebook paper taped to the front door. It should say in clear and neatly written letters, Ojos Cerrados. Upon finding this paper, it is imperative that you burn it in your fireplace. Make sure no one sees the paper, nor the burning of it. Your last sign will be that you will go to bed at 12 o'clock, unintentionally. Even upon knowing that you will, you'll do so without intention. Now, this is the time to get comfy and adjust whatever needs to be adjusted, like pillows and other things. This is the only chance you will get to move at all until sunrise, so take clever advantage of it. Once you get into a position that you are sure you will not toss and turn in, you will fall to sleep. You will have plenty of dreams during your time of sleep. Dreams you never knew were possible. Dreams so real, you feel as if it's more than a dream. Like you're really there. Do not take this time for granted, and enjoy it while you can. Your pleasure will turn to fear real soon. By the time your dreams are over, you will become fully aware of the noises around you, as if you just closed your eyes and went to bed. Your eyes still closed. Be sure to keep them that way for the next 2 hours. It should now be 4 o'clock, and 2 hours until sunrise. Now, Trapo's game begins. You'll start to hear a scratching sound at your door. Trapo Espiritu has arrived. The scratching will carry on for a minute or two before stopping dead in its tracks. Your nose will begin to itch greatly. Don't scratch it. The itch will go away on its own. Trapo is now spiritually connected to you. Now, let's discuss Trapo's appearance, since you'll never see it for yourself if you want to survive. Trapo has the body of a normal human being. He stands at about 6'3" tall, and is a bit round at the waist. Trapo is no human, though. He is made up of messily sewn rags and leaves. He still makes out a perfect humanoid look, though. His face, no different than yours or mine, except with two sewn-up eyes. Trapo cannot see you, find you, or kill you while his eyes are sewn shut. The only way his eyes can open is by none other than you. Since Trapo Espiritu is now spiritually connected to you, you pull the trigger of your own demise. If you open your eyes even the slightest bit, it will cause the stitching in its eyes to unravel. Then it will be able to see and kill you in its slow and gruesome manner. However did I escape? When Trapo attacked, I managed to evade its attack and locked it in my room to buy me some time. Don't think that this means you can run away from Trapo once you've opened your eyes. Once Trapo's eyes have been opened, it will follow you until given the chance to kill you, if not done there and then. I have only mere minutes left of my life until it comes. I cannot stop it. All I can do is warn you. So, I continue here. After your nose itches for some time, Trapo will now be in the room with you. Its stench is like that of rotting eggs and scum. Its voice, raspy and deep. Trapo will begin its game by crawling up the walls and ceiling at a slow, eerie pace, making noise while doing so. Ignore this and keep your eyes shut. Trapo will notice your resistance and will begin to call your name in its grotesque, deep voice while still crawling. Keep your eyes shut and don't move. Try imagining something that you would really like to do. That will make it easier to ignore. Trapo won't stop there, though. It will move on to things even more tempting. You may hear a breaking of glass or ripping of stuffing. It may sound and feel like your favorite toy or most prized possession is being ruined. Don't worry. Trapo cannot break or touch any of your things. At least, not when its eyes are still sewn closed. Trapo will then begin to cheat a little bit, as you may feel some sort of liquid dripping onto your face. Mere drips. But still, keep quiet, calm, and eyes stay shut. If you made it this far, it should now be 5 o'clock. 1 hour left until sunrise. 1 hour left to go through this. Trapo Espiritu will be well aware of this and will start using more drastic tactics than before. The slight creaks you heard on your walls and ceiling will turn into violent thumping. Your name being called, this will now have morphed into a very recognizable voice of a loved one of yours who most likely passed. Don't be fooled. This is not your loved one. Just another one of Trapo's impersonations. The voice will grow louder and more demanding the longer time goes on. The liquid dripping on your face will have increased in rate, and you may feel drenched by it. If you have still not opened your eyes and kept silent, then it should now be 5:50 in the morning. Only 10 more minutes. Now, Trapo is starting to get desperate. The thumping you heard will now be replaced by what feels like an earthquake in your room. Your bed will start shaking violently. Covers thrown off of you. The liquid will have stopped, but this is replaced by the terrifying fact that Trapu is now on the end of your bed. Your eyes are almost able to open on their own, so you must now keep your eyes closed as tightly as possible. Stay calm. Stay still. Keep your eyes closed. It's almost over. Trapo's demanding shout of your name in a loved one's voice will now have changed to a violent screech of your name in the same voice, but warped and ruined. It is now 1 minute until sunrise. 1 minute left. Stay strong. Stay calm. Stay still. Don't scream. Keep your eyes closed. Your bed is now shaking even more violently than before. Your head vibrating. Your body shivering in the freezing cold. Your ears shriveling from the piercing scream of the malevolent entity. Trapo Espiritu is now right on top of you. Its face inches from yours. It cannot kill you, and it cannot hurt you, but it can scare you. This is an ultimate test of bravery. An ultimate test of trust. You are now face to face with a powerful and evil being, able to kill you with ease, and the only thing that is protecting you are your two shut tight eyes. The last 10 seconds have come. With that, Trapper will scream loudly, horribly. You will feel the residue of spit and heat and stench coming from its unnaturally wide mouth as it blasts your eardrums with its shriek. Then, as soon as it started, as it will seem, it will have stopped. All of it will have stopped. The shaking, the screaming, and even the liquid on your face will be gone. Your covers will be on your bed, and nothing will have changed. Everything will be just as it was yesterday. Not a single thing moved. Sunrise has come, and it is now safe to get up. When you do, you will have forgotten about your encounter with the being, and even about the previous day. Trapu Espiritu will have gone, and will have taken your memory of it, and the day before, with it. It does not want you to remember it if you survive, and make sure you don't. You will serve yourself breakfast in your kitchen, and when you do, you will find a small white paper on your kitchen table that says, Frequentar Finales. Or haunting ends. It will all be over then. You'll end up throwing the paper away and going on with your normal life. Trapu Espiritu will never haunt you again. You have won the game, and Trapu will go on to find another unlucky player. If you have, then thank you for listening this far. And I hope this information helps you. I finished talking to you just in time. I can now smell the stench of rotting eggs and scum, and can hear the scratching at the closet door. Trapu Espiritu is upon me. And so once again, we reach the end of tonight's podcast. My thanks, as always, to the authors of those wonderful stories, and to you for taking the time to listen. Now, I'd ask one small favor of you. Wherever you get your podcast from, please write a few nice words and leave a 5-star review, as it really helps the podcast. That's it for this week, but I'll be back again same time, same place, and I do so hope you'll join me once more. Until next time, sweet dreams and bye-bye.